It's not just the messy primaries. Politics in Puerto Rico have been riddled with chaos, and Puerto Ricans are taking note.
People are learning what's wrong, what's right, and what's their role in calling out bad behavior.
I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 18th, we break down Puerto Rico's current political turbulence. Also, how our national parks have often been mainly white spaces, but how that is changing.
What we're seeing right now is more people of color being welcome and engaged as part of the national park experience.
And today marks the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which granted all white women the right to vote. We break down the legacy of the 19th Amendment. But first, we take a big look at voting by mail. For weeks, President Trump has had the United States Postal Service in his crosshairs. And last Thursday on Fox News, he said the quiet part out loud.
They want $25 billion, billion, for the post office. Now, they need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. Now, in the meantime, they aren't getting there. By the way, those are just two items. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting.
This admission caused outrage in Washington and beyond. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the chamber back to meet this Saturday with the hope of providing $25 billion to the Postal Service. And the House Oversight Committee has called on Louis DeJoy, the new Postmaster General, to testify next Monday. As we inch closer and closer to the November election, mail-in voting is taking center stage. Millions are seeking to use the Postal Service to submit their ballots amid the global pandemic. Joining us now is Jacob Bogage, a business reporter for The Washington Post, covering the U.S. Postal Service. Jacob, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Amber McReynolds, CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, which promotes access to mail-in ballots across the country. Thank you, Amber.
Thank you for having me.
Jacob, let's begin with the fight between Congress and the executive branch over the management of the Postal Service. What's the status of that today?
Well, it's heating up very early on today. News I broke this morning that the Senate on Friday will hold a hearing with the Postmaster General. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee will hold a hearing with the Postmaster General to look into these delays and also see what kind of financial assistance the Postal Service truly needs. As you mentioned, there's been this push and pull between the White House and Congress over who gets to exercise oversight authority, and that authority really does reside with Congress, not the White House. And we'll see that exercised Friday, and we'll see it exercised Monday in the House.
Jacob, at this point, are there enough funds for the post office to successfully carry out vote-by-mail elections across the country in November?
Absolutely, there are. The Postal Service has $15 billion in cash on hand right now. If it somehow blows through that, which would be problematic. But if it somehow blows through that, it's got $10 billion more in a loan from the Treasury Department that it can access. That's plenty of money for the Postal Service to get through between now and November. It really should tide them over until between March and October of 2021. So when the president said he wanted to deprive the Postal Service of funding to facilitate vote by mail, that's problematic, but he's got one thing wrong, and that is the Postal Service already has enough money to do that.
What are the concerns you're hearing from lawmakers about how the post office is preparing for the upcoming election? And do these concerns really break on partisan lines?
The main concern, and this is something we've heard for some time now, is are these deadlines that voters impose on, that states impose on their voters for deadlines for registration, deadlines to get your ballot submitted, deadlines to request an absentee ballot, are those compatible with Postal Service delivery standards? In years past, the Postal Service has really gone out of its way, even on deadlines that it found unreasonable and incompatible with its delivery standards, to make sure that it devoted extra resources to those areas. And the message has been very different this year. The message has kind of been, we warned you, and now you're on your own. You should think about changing your laws. You should think about changing your requirements. But we warned you, and so if something doesn't get in, don't blame us. That's a very different tack the Postal Service is taking this time around than it had even in 2018. And that's what has a lot of people very concerned.
Hmm. Amber, I want to bring you into this conversation. When we think about this November election, you know, how many states allow voters to cast mail-in ballots, and what does the process normally look like?
So every state in the country actually has vote by mail as an option to vote. That varies greatly. Some states, it's an automatic process where the government is sending active registered voters their ballot automatically. So that's actually much more efficient from an administrative perspective because they don't have to process all of those requests. And that's very much like the model that I helped to design in Colorado now 7 years ago. And then it goes to the other end of the spectrum where voters are required to provide an excuse. Sometimes that's limited based on age. Sometimes you have to have a notary. So it varies by state. But every single state in the country offers vote by mail as an option. So this is, you know, the impact of all of this is widespread. It covers all states.
And some states have expanded eligibility to absentee ballots because of coronavirus concerns. How many states have done that?
Well, there's been quite a few. In fact, we're actually now, as of today, given the recent announcement from New Jersey, there's now 9 states plus the D.C. area, so Washington, D.C., that is actually planning to send ballots to every single elector. Most recently, Nevada, New Jersey, Vermont, all passed legislation to send a ballot automatically. And then a lot of states have waived some of their excuse requirements, or they've added COVID or COVID concerns as an excuse. So there's been a massive expansion this year. But I think more importantly than even the legislative activity or sort of what politicians have decided is that voters are opting themselves in to vote this way in historic and record numbers. And so that's why, you know, some of these impacts with the Postal Service is critical. And, you know, one of the other aspects of this is, like election administration, like election officials, the Postal Service should be free from partisan politics, and it should be about service to the public at large. And so that's what I think is extremely concerning when we see any one of those two things, election administration or the Postal Service politicized. It can create a lot of issues, and both entities are here to serve the public, and that's the key and the most important thing that they do on a daily basis.
Amber, I'm hoping you can give our listeners some guidance, some best practices. Now, obviously, elections are administered locally, but can you talk about what voters can do to make sure that their ballots are being counted and received on time and cast properly?
Absolutely. So what's really important right now is timing. So the key today, I would encourage everybody who's listening today or tomorrow to check your registration. Make sure you're registered to vote, update your address if you need to. And then if you want to vote by mail, file the request today. We know in a lot of states that are not automatically sending a ballot, there's going to be a lot of people signing up. And so that's going to backlog election officials in terms of processing requests. So do it as soon as possible. And then when you get your ballot, send it back and turn it in as soon as you're ready to. The earlier you do that, the better it is. We recommend not mailing the ballot after 8 days prior to the election. Again, the rules and regulations vary by state. Some accept postmark, some do not. So a good rule of thumb for the entire country is to mail it no later than 8 days prior to the election, or drop it off in person like so many Americans are choosing to do across the country, which is why there's been such an expansion of secure ballot drop boxes manned by election officials.
Amber, I want to play for you a call from a listener about his plans for the upcoming election.
Hi, I'm Gabriel calling from the Bronx in New York City. I'm planning on either doing early voting or voting in person first thing on Election Day. I unfortunately don't feel like I can trust the Postal Service right now with Trump trying to destroy and gut it.
Amber, I'm wondering if you can reply to what you're hearing in that caller, that sort of juxtaposition of people making choices to find other ways to vote versus vote by mail because of this fight over the post office.
Well, I think that it is an individual choice and decision. However, what I would say, and again, as someone who ran elections for 13 years and served voters, I believe that voters having more days and more time to vote their ballot, make their choices, and turn it in rather than all on one day and sort of taking a risk that everything goes perfectly on the one day is better for voters to have that more time and more options. So for me personally, I like to have time to make my selections at home and research issues and do all of that. But again, it's a personal choice by all voters. I would say that I think a lot more voters like to have their unvoted ballot mailed to them, and then we're seeing a significant increase drop it off in person, which alleviates that worry about the post office and the ballot not making it in time. The second thing I would say is a lot of states and localities have also expanded what's called and known as ballot tracking. And that's very similar to tracking a package. You can sign up and get an email or a text notification about where your ballot is at every moment in the process so that you get that confirmation, especially when it's received by election officials. And that technology was pioneered in Denver, Colorado, and now it's in multiple states, including California, Michigan, and North Carolina, Georgia. They're all in the middle of implementing that type of system, as well as New Jersey. So there's been a huge expansion of that. We're going to continue to see more states announce those sorts of programs, and that just gives voters extra accountability and transparency as to where their ballot is.
Jacob, just briefly, you know, this is not just an issue for elections, right? The fight over the Postal Service is a fight over all the other things people rely on the Postal Service for a host of necessities. Can you talk about, just briefly, some of the stakes in this broader fight for post office funding?
Absolutely. So in the near term, we're looking at obviously so much more than ballots. We're looking at prescription medications that folks get in the mail. We're looking at bills and paychecks if Congress passes another round of stimulus spending that sends Americans checks in the mail. You know, those are, for a lot of people, are going to come through the Postal Service. There's a lot of reasons why a functioning democracy needs a Postal Service. In the long term, we're looking at an agency that will have to kind of reshape itself. I mean, the Postal Service is designed to deal with paper and not boxes. Well, paper mail volumes continue to decline. They've declined for a decade, and analysts say they're probably not going to come back up because who's sending that much paper mail anymore? But package volumes are going way up because everyone's buying stuff online because we're stuck at home during a pandemic. And the question is, if consumer behaviors stay the same and package volumes continue to increase, does the Postal Service need to realign itself to deal better with those items?
Jacob Bogage is a business reporter for The Washington Post, and Amber McReynolds is the CEO for the National Vote at Home Institute. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
We asked you, how do you plan to vote in November? Are you confident your vote will count?
Hi, this is Joy from Florida. In the November election, I plan on doing my regular Florida mail-in ballot, but I plan to deliver it myself to the Board of Elections. Our mailman is great. I have complete confidence in him, period. I just don't have confidence in the Board of Elections.
Hey, this is Chris from Seattle, Washington. Here in Washington State, I've been voting by mail for years without issue. Looking forward to that familiar process this year and help the rest of my fellow Americans get to give it a shot as well.
Hi, this is Leslie from Bergen County, New Jersey. I will be voting by mail as I have for the past several years in New Jersey. They've made it really easy to do. I am reconsidering using the post office and may use the special drop boxes that will be available in our county. I will also be voting as soon as I receive my ballot.
Some of you told us you feel confident in vote by mail because your state offers ballot tracking.
Hi, my name is Don, and I'm calling from Ashland, Oregon. My wife and I moved to Oregon last year, where mail-in voting has been used successfully for many years. Registered voters here receive their ballots about 2 to 3 weeks before the election, leaving more than enough time to research the options. Voters can either mail back those ballots or use one of the many available drop boxes. Voter fraud in Oregon is taken very, very seriously, and there have been no significant issues with this approach since its inception. We feel confident that mail-in voting, it will work for us here, and it is certainly a more convenient way for us to do it, especially in the midst of the pandemic.
Yes, my name is Jane Feldman. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and we are very lucky in Colorado to have a safe, secure, and convenient mail-in ballot system. The minute my ballot arrives, I will fill it out and then drop it off in one of the 38 drop boxes that currently are in the city and county of Denver. And I'm going to do that in plenty of time. And then I will get a text from the city and county of Denver telling me that my ballot has been received and that my vote has been counted. It's a great system. It is not fraudulent at all. And it really should be adopted across the country.
Hello, this is Marvin Ramirez. I live in Redondo Beach, California. I will receive my ballot in the mail. I have already signed up for ballot tracks. I will complete my ballot early and personally drop it off at an authorized drop-off center. I will then monitor its progress through the system.
And some of you said you'll vote in person despite the pandemic because you're concerned that your ballots won't be counted if you mail them in.
Hi, this is Lisa calling from Rainham, Massachusetts. And I'm calling to confirm that I will be voting in person in my polling place because I am concerned about the ability for my ballot to be cast and counted if I mail it. I also am voting in person because I have paper ballots in Massachusetts. I think that if I were in a state that used electronic voting, I would definitely do the absentee ballot and then bring it to the polling place and check how that works because I think electronic voting is very easily manipulated.
Hi, my name is George and I live in Berkeley, Massachusetts. I live in a fairly small town in a somewhat rural area. Voting is always pretty simple for us. The town does a great job, so I will be voting in person. I will probably vote early to make sure there are no crowds.
Thanks as always for weighing in. If you haven't yet, you can tell us how you're planning to cast your ballot this November. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Last week, we brought you the story of Puerto Rico's August 9th primary day, a chaotic scene across the island where many Puerto Ricans were turned away from polling places that didn't have enough ballots. So this past Sunday, the island held a second day of primary voting, and in the end, Governor Wanda Vasquez has lost the primary of her pro-statehood party to Pedro Pierluisi, a former representative in Congress for the island. But on Monday morning, in Puerto Rico, it wasn't the primary results grabbing headlines. Outlets were reporting that the FBI had arrested Puerto Rico legislator Maria Milagros Charbonnier and three others in connection with a public corruption scheme. It was the latest in a string of cases that have rocked the island, with Puerto Ricans speaking out against corruption since last summer's resignation of Governor Rosselló. Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News, and she joins us now to talk about the political situation in Puerto Rico and what to watch for in the days ahead. Nicole, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Let's start with this corruption case. What do we know about it so far?
Well, we know that a House representative from Puerto Rico was arrested yesterday morning. Her name is Maria Milagros Charbonnier. She was arrested alongside her husband, her son, and one of the employees in her legislative office. They're facing charges of conspiracy, federal funds theft, bribery, fraud, money laundering, obstruction of justice, among others. So the representative yesterday pleaded not guilty to these charges. But when you look at the indictment, it's pretty clear this scheme authorities sort of lay out on this indictment is the classic kickback scheme, which is a type of bribery.
And this was a representative who was actually on the ballot over the weekend, right?
Yes. And she lost her primary So she was reeling from that loss, really, that morning that she got arrested. And I mean, these arrests were sort of up in the air. The feds went to her home last month and they confiscated her phones, iPads. So I think that people sort of knew that this was happening, and they spoke about that and with their votes, and they voted her out in the primary.
What are you hearing from Puerto Ricans about these arrests, and how do they fit into the story of Puerto Rico's government over the last few years?
I would say they really much do, especially last year with the mass protests and the political scandal that ended up ousting former Governor Rosselló. People are way more vigilant about what their officials are doing, what corruption is, something that the FBI officials brought up during their press conference on this case yesterday was that a lot of these behaviors are normalized in a lot of legislative offices in Puerto Rico. And I think that people are learning what's wrong, what's right, and what's their role in calling out bad behavior, especially on an island that has been facing crisis after crisis. Right now, the Puerto Rico is in a position that they're really dependent on the federal government when it comes to recovering money from Hurricane Maria, recovering money for earthquakes, getting out of the biggest bankruptcy any U.S. jurisdiction has ever seen. So the Puerto Rican people are not playing around. They're trying their best to call out officials. And when they see wrongdoing, they either say something or they just vote them out.
Now, what was supposed to be the news, of course, was the other recent primary results, namely Wanda Vasquez's defeat. Why did she lose her bid?
Wanda Vasquez, we have to remind ourselves that she is an unelected governor. She's been a controversial figure since the beginning. She rose to power after former Governor Rosselló was ousted and resigned. And, you know, they needed a governor. So she ended up racing to power from the sequence of the power structure in Puerto Rico. And her first crisis that she needed to prove herself as a leader was the earthquakes in January. And right now, she is being investigated by the Puerto Rican Department of Justice about management of supplies, emergency supplies during the earthquakes. And I think that also a little bit like what happened with Representative Charbonnier, these investigations, like sort of this talk that things are not going well, didn't work well for her. Also, the fact that the primary itself was botched. We have to remind ourselves that just last month, she signed a law that changed the electoral code in Puerto Rico. And that had consequences. And, you know, it played a role into why this primary was cut in half. And we were talking about results today and yesterday instead of last week when the primaries were originally scheduled to happen. So I think that a combination of all these things, just people said, you know what, we don't want you to stay in office. We don't want to make you an elected governor.
Nicole, can you talk about some of the other notable primary results?
Yeah, this year we had for the main opposition party on the island, the mayor of San Juan Carmen, Yulín Cruz, who became known after Hurricane Maria from her disputes with President Trump. She was running for governor against Charlie Delgado and a senator, Eduardo Batia. She lost that primary by a significant margin, I might add. She came third in her own town of San Juan, and Charlie took that win. And a lot of the, I think he won for like, at least from the votes that were counted as of last night, like almost 70%. Of the votes in that primary. And the other notable win was, like you mentioned, Bridget Pierluisi, who's a figure to watch in the sense that he briefly rose to power before Wanda Vasquez and was governor right after Rosselló was ousted for like a weekend until the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico decided that the way he became governor was not constitutional. Right now, it's just a matter of seeing whether his campaign could sell him again as a governor and this time have the people elect him.
Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, thank you as always.
Thank you.
American leaders have long held up the national parks as physical representations of our country's highest aspirations and ideals. Teddy Roosevelt called the parks one of the best bits of national achievement which our people have to their credit. And writer and historian Wallace Stegner famously called them the best idea we ever had, absolutely American, absolutely democratic. They reflect us at our best rather than our worst. But these places have not necessarily lived up to these lofty descriptions. Today, we continue our week-long conversation about national parks with a look at how Americans of color were excluded from them, starting decades before Woodrow Wilson established the National Park Service in August 1916.
The same areas of segregation that existed during the Woodrow Wilson administration carried through our national parks and other wild and scenic places all the way up through the 1940s and into the 1950s. And many of these public spaces weren't fully desegregated until the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That's James Edward Mills, a freelance journalist and the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. Segregation and other forms of systemic racism have had a lasting effect on who visits these parks today. According to a 2018 study, less than 2% of national park visitors were Black. But James, along with environmental educator Nicole Jackson, a Next Generation Advisory Council member at the National Parks Conservation Association, told Tanzina Vega that this disparity is beginning to change.
Many of these public spaces weren't fully desegregated until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So much of what we imagine as our national parks being an open and egalitarian space for public access really wasn't for everyone until very late in the 20th century. So what we're seeing right now is a relatively new phenomenon of seeing more people of color being welcome and engaged as part of, you know, the national park experience.
What effect did that type of segregation have on the relationship that people of color in the United States have with the national parks? Because we know attendance is quite low.
Well, I think a big part of it has to do with segregation in all aspects of American life. I mean, we have divisions in terms of how people spend much of their time, whether we're talking about education or science or access to public health care or a variety of other things. The national parks and other outdoor recreation opportunities were part of that. And so one of the things that is also added to the mix is the very real possibility of racially motivated violence that could occur in wooded areas, which our long storied history of lynching basically takes place in wooded areas. With that, you have the de facto segregation of housing discrimination of the 1930s that again carried on through the 1960s that prevented people of color from living, working, playing, going to places outside of areas that were primarily urban. And that ultimately gets reinforced and codified into African-American culture, so much so that you have entire generations of people who tell themselves and tell each other that camping isn't for us. You know, spending time in the outdoors isn't for us. And unfortunately, that becomes part of, you know, the African-American identity, you know, so much so that we say things like Black people don't camp. And when we take a look at how we go about correcting that, really the only way we can do that is to hopefully do a better job of telling history of Black people in the outdoors, which goes all the way back to the beginning of the national park system, but unfortunately was made unaware to a lot of people because we don't have very much in the way of stories that are being told. But fortunately, the Park Service is doing a much better job of doing that today than they have in years past.
It's interesting that you should say that because there is this duality, I think, for myself, being a Puerto Rican woman who grew up in low-income housing and, you know, in quote-unquote urban areas in New York City, just access to urban parks wasn't a thing. We just didn't do that. But at the same time, we would spend a lot of time in nature in Puerto Rico when we visited there. So there was this sort of disconnect. Nicole, I'm curious, did you have a similar experience with nature growing up where you just were not as, it just wasn't as accessible? Did you feel subject to the stereotype that made you feel like you didn't belong in the outdoors or that just wasn't something that you were going to do?
Yeah, so I am originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I grew up in a big family, 10 siblings. I have 7 sisters and 3 brothers. And grew up in inner city Cleveland. And I actually do have a lot of memories being in inner city Cleveland, visiting a lot of our neighborhood pocket parks, but not anything nature related. It was a lot of gatherings, you know, to have barbecues and picnics with family members for reunions or just to catch up, and then, you know, basketball or recess when we were in school. So that was pretty much the gist of my exposure to the outdoors growing up.
And did you also, I'm wondering if there was also, there's sort of a stereotype that camping and outdoor activity is a masculine thing versus a woman thing?
Yes, definitely. And I think that comes a lot with just knowledge of how to do things when you're going out, whether you're by yourself or with family or with friends, that there's this, you know, amount of knowledge that you need in order to be outdoors camping or doing any type of recreation successfully from a gender's perspective.
James, some of the best known, I should say, conservationists in this country are all white guys, despite people of color having played an important role in the creation of national parks. Give me some examples of what you were talking about in terms of the roles that people of color have played.
Well, I frankly, we really need to go back no further than the beginning of the national park system and the creation of national parks like Yosemite. In 1903 to 1906, over 400 members of the U.S. Cavalry, a unit known as the Buffalo Soldiers, an all African-American contingent of U.S. Army regulars, were charged with protecting and patrolling Yosemite and Sequoia National Park. And many of the campsites and trails that they established then are still in use today. You know, we can also take a look at Stephen Bishop, who before the Civil War was leading trips as a guide through Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. There's also a gentleman by the name of Lancelot Jones, who was a fishing guide in Biscayne Bay, who donated the land and created the advocacy for the creation of Biscayne National Park in Florida. You know, so the history of people of color's participation in the outdoors, especially when it comes to national parks, goes literally all the way back to the beginning. It's the telling of that history that I think is really important that we need to do more of today so that we inspire and encourage more people of color to be part of the national park experience. You know, what Wallace Stegner described as America's best idea.
We talked a little bit about this earlier, but I'm just curious about how, you know, to me, geography has a lot to do with it, too, and just the ability to get to some of these parks. My family didn't own a car when I was growing up, so anywhere we went had to be accessible by public transportation, and that often didn't include a lot of the national parks that we had access to, and there are many reasons for that historically in New York, the way New York was designed. But I'm wondering how that, Nicole, has had, what effect that's had on children of color, in particular families of color who live in cities.
Yes, that was definitely an issue for me. I actually don't own a vehicle. I actually don't have a driver's license. So I, to this day, still use public transportation. And growing up, my first visit to Cuyahoga Valley National Park was in sixth grade, through a field trip. And I didn't know at the time that we were actually going to a national park in Ohio. I thought it was just another faraway place that had a lot of, you know, trees and trails. And I didn't necessarily feel connected to the space. But then as I got older, I realized it was connected to our metro park system, which is more accessible through public transportation. And the more information I found out in terms of what parks I can go to that were closer to where I lived, the more I understood that there is some connection to being able to go on my own by car with other family members, but still connecting to that space and not necessarily having to, like, for example, I felt like I had to go with white friends to those types of places to enjoy them. And if that didn't happen, it would be years before, you know, we had another family reunion or we went to a park similar to that and felt like, okay, this is something we can do as a family on our own.
James, in 2017, President Obama issued a memorandum called Promoting Diversity and Inclusion in Our National Parks, National Forests, and Other Public Lands and Waters. Did it actually do what it was intended to do?
Well, as most presidential memorandums go, you know, they basically are provisions or suggestions on how government agencies should perform. And if you go to you know, many of the park managers and park supervisors, they will tell you that they are diligently working to create diversity, equity, inclusion programs of some kind. But without the reinforcing narrative that comes from the Department of the Interior, right down from the president, to say, these are the things that I would like to see as part of my administration to have better representation, both in terms of employment, in terms of management, in terms of visitation. You know, the agencies are really only as capable of honoring this presidential memorandum as they have the power to enforce it. Now, it's safe to say that things indeed are happening, but frankly, there just hasn't been enough happening in the last 4 years. I mean, there have been many great opportunities to try to expand the participation of more types of people in public land management, and it's not happening to the degree that I personally would like to see it, but I definitely think that it's an ongoing process, and there just needs to be more activation and activists that will go on to make sure that we create opportunities for more people of color in particular to experience the outdoors in a positive way.
Nicole, are there specific initiatives that the National Park Services is doing to increase inclusivity and diversity at its parks?
Yeah, so I definitely remember specifically the Every Kid in a Park initiative, and that was something that really stood out to me because it was allotted to every fourth grader to get a free pass visit to a national park with their family, which I thought was great. But I think there's still some kind of gaps that need to be filled in terms of how that's continuing to be promoted. And do people feel like they have easy access to those initiatives? And if not, what can still be improved? And in terms of the Great American Outdoors Act or bill being passed, I think there's definitely more opportunities to step it up and really show communities of color that they can be a part of the stories and the narratives as we continue forward in preserving our national parks and also being, you know, continuing to be advocates and help people really see the beauty, but also the community involved in bringing those pieces together is definitely needed.
And James, what about you? What do you think could be done to further this idea of more diverse park attendance?
A lot of what can be done is being done by the general public. I mean, one of the great revelations of the last decade has been the increased appearance of people of color in social media. You know, we're seeing fabulous pictures of African-Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, Asian people, you know, taking their pictures in parks and literally creating agency to encourage their family members, their peers, to go out and have these positive experiences. You know, and one of the things that I think that many people are realizing is once they get there, that there are things that they can do to help improve those areas, whether it is exercising principles of leave no trace, to pick up trash, to do a better job of educating young people in particular to recognize the importance and value of public land, but also perhaps more than anything else, you know, making sure that these lands are protected for future generations so that, you know, 20, 30, 50, 60 years from now, there will indeed be a generation of stewards who will carry on the legacy of public land management.
James Edward Mills is a freelance journalist and the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. And Nicole Jackson is an environmental educator and Next Generation Advisory Council member at the National Parks Conservation Association. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Today marks the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote in the U.S., but it really only applied to white women. Black women and other women of color continued to face voter discrimination long after its ratification. Still, the 19th Amendment was a milestone for the decades-long movement for women's suffrage.
We actually aren't taught a lot about women's history overall. So if we're getting snippets along the way, then Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton sort of became a shorthand for a movement that was much longer than the 1920 moment, but it was also much, much more diverse.
Veronica Chambers is the editor of narrative projects at the New York Times and co-author of the children's book, Finish the Fight. She says the suffrage movement has become whitewashed in our history books. While the names of Anthony and Stanton are well known today, that's not the case with countless women of color that were key to making women's suffrage a reality. I asked Veronica all about this, starting with how we should reconcile the work of white suffragists like Anthony and Stanton with their complicated history on issues like race.
The moment that everything breaks down is the 15th Amendment. When black men get the vote before white women, it's infuriating to some suffragists. And so they break apart, and the movement doesn't really come together again until the early 20th century. And so there was that moment, and it, I think, echoes a lot of what we've seen, not to be flip, but a lot of the Karen moments that we talk about in this year, where there are some white suffragists who are like, how dare a formerly black man who was enslaved go before me in this right? And yet for people like Frederick Douglass, the idea was that in order for slavery not to come back, black men needed the vote.
I think some of what is so phenomenal about this work is you highlight the different racial, socioeconomic, and ethnic backgrounds of the women who made suffrage a reality. Who were some of the other prominent black women at the forefront of this movement?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, Ida B. Wells Barnett, you know, famously in 1913, Alice Paul organizes this parade, and Ida B. Wells comes with a contingent from Chicago. She starts the Alpha Suffrage Club, and she wants to march in the parade with the Chicago contingent, and Alice Paul is afraid to anger the Southern white women that she feels she needs the support to get suffrage across, and she asks Ida B. Wells to march at the back. And Ida B. Wells refuses. And when the Chicago contingent passes her, she marches alongside them. There are women like Mary Church Terrell, whose parents were enslaved, but she goes on to become one of the first black women to graduate from Oberlin. She's a linguist. She's fluent in French and German, travels throughout Europe, does a suffrage speech in Europe in the late 1800s.
Another name you just mentioned, Mabel Ping Hua Lee, a Chinese-American suffragist who led one of the biggest suffrage parades in U.S. history. How do Mabel and her efforts fit into the larger suffrage movement?
Mabel Ping Hua Lee is one of our favorites. She was a Chinese immigrant who grew up in Chinatown when Chinatown was still just, you know, coming of age. Her father spoke English, and so he was kind of the unofficial mayor of Chinatown. And at the age of 16, she started attending suffrage meetings, and she marched in the parade. She sat on a white horse and helped to lead this parade, knowing that the Chinese Exclusion Act meant that when the 19th Amendment passed, she herself would not get the vote. Mm-hmm. And I think that, to me, is one of the consistent things that we learn about suffrage, is that it took three generations of women to get the vote. That means people lived, they died, their daughters fought for it, they died, and then their daughters got to vote. And only one woman who attended Seneca Falls was alive to vote in 1920. I like to say that suffragists were futurists. These were women who fought for something that they knew they might not get in their lifetime, but they believed that for the future of the democracy, they needed to fight for future women to have a political voice.
You also note that the suffragists drew a lot of inspiration from indigenous communities, right?
Yes. So Seneca Falls is located in what was the Haudenosaunee territory, also known as one of the tribes of the Iroquois Nation. And early suffragists like Matilda Joslyn Gage, they took a lot of inspiration for the fact that Native American women had a political voice in choosing the chief and choosing the laws of the nation. And there was this feeling that the Seneca Falls and the movement that followed, it was rooted in sort of the outspoken abolitionist activism, but also scholars like Sally Wagner have begun to write about the importance of realizing how inspirational Native American women were to the suffragist movement and how Native American suffragists themselves, like Sikala Saw and Marie Bottineau Baldwin, were to the movement. And they were fighting for both citizenry rights for Native Americans as well as for the women's right to vote. So in 1920, when the 19th Amendment passes, Native American women can actually vote because they're not citizens of the U.S. And so the Native people don't get the vote till 1924 and the Snyder Act.
I love your description of the suffragists as futurists because, as you make clear, the 19th Amendment was not the end, but really just the beginning of women's suffrage in the U.S. Can you talk some more about that?
Sure. So when we started talking to historians, scholars, curators who've made suffrage their life work, the one thing that they said consistently is that 1920 was a big win. It is the biggest enfranchisement of people in American history at once. But because of the Jim Crow tendencies that turned Black Americans away from the polls, because of the exclusion of Native American and Asian Americans from the polls, we also see on the borders really Jim Crow tactics among Latinx citizens that they much more point to the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as the real end of the suffrage movement.
Women of color continue to face barriers when it came to voting. Did you discover things that surprised you, things that were beyond anything that you had learned in history books?
What was so interesting to me is having really known and written about and studied the whole history of Black women in electoral politics and how vital Black women have been as the backbone of the Democratic Party. You know, as Kimberly Crenshaw said, we show up and show out at the polls. What you really look at when you look at the club movement of the 19th century, you realize that this has been going on for more than 100 years. These are women who organized and they took on every cause. They never said, as I think some suffragists did, we have to focus on one thing because we'll distill our power. They focused on child labor laws. They focused on domestic violence. They focused on human rights and equality. And it was constant anti-lynching. And so the multiplicity of tasks that the Black Woman Club movement and these Black suffragists took on was just staggering. And I think that, you know, in some ways, it really led the best of the movement.
How much of what suffragists were fighting for then is still relevant today?
It's kind of incredible that the centennial is coming about in an election year. The fact is that you realize that up until the very moment that it passes, there's this idea that suffrage is a ridiculous thing. I mean, there's a quote from the New York Times, which was quite conservative in that moment. And in 1913, in an editorial, the New York Times said the benefits of women's suffrage are almost wholly imaginary. Its penalties will be real and hard to bear. The fact is that people did not want women to have the vote because the vote is powerful. And we are seeing levels of barriers to voting continue. And I think even just to remind everyday citizens that three generations of women fought for the vote because they knew that it made a difference. I just would hope that this anniversary really inspires some people to get to the polls and to exercise this hard fought for right.
Veronica Chambers is the editor of Narrative Projects at the New York Times. Veronica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you can call in and share any thoughts about any of these stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or you can send me a tweet at Bridget Bergen. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. I'll be here with you guys all week, so more to come tomorrow.